Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. One of the recurring themes that we've returned to over many years in these lectures is the notion of some sort of constitutional or statutory guarantee of rights. It's been covered in a number of lectures in this series, and it's suddenly become a hot topic now. Out on the desk in the outer room there, you will find advertisements for two other seminars on the subject, both involving an ardent proponent of the idea of a Charter of Rights. And I noticed in the press cuttings this morning there were at least two major articles in the press on the subject this morning. And I think, without checking, I think I would be correct in saying that overwhelmingly the discussion is pro the notion of a Bill of Rights. Well, today we've decided to do our little bit to correct that. We've got a very distinguished academic gentleman who's going to give you the case against the Bill of Rights. Please welcome Professor James Allen.
Well, thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here. I'd like to thank the Clerk of the Senate, Mr. Evans, and Ms. Jillian Kimber, who did all of my arrangements, which included, because of the lack of daylight savings time in Queensland, which is the last remnant of federalism, as far as I can tell. But because of that, I had to leave so early that I had to go through Sydney. And Qantas Airlines then puts us on a little turboprop up, and so we all got on the bus to go to the plane, and they packed two buses, and so we all got on, and the bus drove maybe 25 yards to the plane, and then we all got off the bus. It was just amazing. At any rate, I will leave plenty of time for questions, so don't worry about that. Well, I resisted the temptation to entitle this talk, "Whaling is for Scientific Purposes, Homeopathy Actually Works, and a Bill of Rights Will Enhance the Role of Parliament." These are a few of my favorite myths. All in all, it was a bit unwieldy, but I think it'll become plain as I proceed why I was tempted, and not least by the dripping sarcasm. Right. Well, many, if not most, of those pushing for some form or other of a Bill of Rights instrument like to point to the fact that Australia is one of the very few democracies, on some counts maybe the only one, without a national Bill of Rights. Now, of course, on its own, such a "we differ from everyone else" type of argument tells us nothing. After all, Australia is one of only two democracies with preferential voting. Only a handful more have compulsory voting. Few have a form of bicameralism with an elected, genuine House of Review, upper house, and many lack federalism. Ought we to change any of these on the sole ground that we stand out from the pack? Of course not. The real question is not whether we should emulate others, but whether a Bill of Rights is a good idea in its own right. Would having one deliver better outcomes than we achieve without one? And my answer is an emphatic and resounding no. Let me give you some of my reasons this afternoon. To start, notice that any sort of Bill of Rights enumerates a list of vague, amorphous, but always emotively appealing moral entitlements expressed in the language of rights. So it operates at a sufficiently high level of abstraction or indeterminacy that it's able to finesse most, if not all, disagreement. So when I go into my class and I ask who's in favor of freedom of expression or freedom of religion or a right to life, virtually everyone puts up his or her hand. I did give this lecture once in Adelaide, and I was warned that there was a gentleman in the room who was in the Nazi party, but even he put his hand up. So, of course, this is where bills of rights are sold. They're sold up in the Olympian heights of disagreement disguising moral abstractions and generalities. This is where they're being sold right now in Australia. But that's not where they have real effect. People don't spend hundreds of thousands of dollars going to court to oppose freedom of speech in the abstract. They don't take a case all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada or the United States or to the House of Lords in the United Kingdom with all the costs and the time and the worries that entails to argue that they're opposed to the freedom of movement or to a right to life or to liberty and security of the person or put in any of the substantive rights enumerated in the Victorian Charter. Bills of rights have real, actual effect down in the quagmire of social policy decision-making, down where there's no consensus, there's no agreement across society at all about what these indeterminate entitlements mean. What you have are smart, reasonable, well-informed, even nice people who simply disagree. They disagree about where to draw the line when it comes to campaign finance rules. They disagree about hate speech provisions or defamation regimes or whether Muslim girls can or cannot wear veils to school or whether to sanction gay marriage and on and on and on and on. You could sit in groups holding hands, singing kumbaya and chanting right to free speech for as long as you wanted, and it wouldn't help you in drawing any of those contentious lines. So what a Bill of Rights does is it takes contentious political issues, and let me say this again, I deliberately say this again, issues over which smart, reasonable, intelligent people disagree, and they disagree reasonably, and a Bill of Rights turns those issues into pseudo-legal issues, which have to be treated as though there were some sort of eternal, timeless right answer. So even where the top judges break 5-4, or they break 4-3 on these issues, the judge's majority view is treated as though it were the view that is in accord with fundamental human rights. The four losers and the five winners, that's the view on what this right means. The effect, as can easily be observed from glancing at the U.S. or Canada or now New Zealand and the U.K., is to diminish politics, and over time to politicize the judiciary. Of course, the irony of the fact that judges resolve their disagreements in these cases by voting is generally missed. So the decision-making rule in every top court in the common law world with the Bill of Rights is this. The decision-making rule is that 5 votes beat 4, regardless of the depth of the moral reasoning in the dissenting judgments. Regardless that the dissenters made more frequent reference to John Stuart Mill or to Milton or to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the difference between Australia without a Bill of Rights and Canada or the UK with a Bill of Rights is just the size of the franchise. In other words, tens of millions of voters versus 7 high court judges if we had a Bill of Rights here. None of this deters Bill of Rights proponents from talking repeatedly about how such an instrument protects fundamental human rights, as though these things were mysteriously or magically self-defining or self-enforcing. They are not. They simply transfer the power to define what counts as, say, a reasonable limit on free speech over to committees of ex-lawyers. That's what high courts are. They're committees of ex-lawyers. And these people have no greater access on these political, not legal, but political and moral issues. They have no pipeline to God on these moral and political issues than anyone else. The only thing is they're immune from being removed by the voters for the decisions they reach. Of course, in the Australian context, proponents who formally championed some sort of an American or Canadian-style constitutionalized Bill of Rights, one that would allow judges to strike down legislation, fall all over themselves now to tell us, after repeated failures by the Australian electors to agree with them on that one, they now tell us that they favor only a statutory Bill of Rights. It's only a statutory Bill of Rights they're now in favor of, and they make much of how these statutory versions formally leave the last word with the elected politicians. By no means is this the sort of Damascene conversion that some proponents would pretend. Quite simply, these statutory versions are virtually as potent as their constitutionalized cousins. They, too, shift much power to the unelected judiciary, however much some proponents may indicate otherwise. Now, the proof of the pudding, of course, is in the eating. And the evidence from New Zealand and the United Kingdom, both jurisdictions that have statutory Bill of Rights, and indeed the ones that were the models that were copied by the state of Victoria, they have a sort of an amalgam of the UK's Human Rights Act and New Zealand's Statutory Bill of Rights Act, the evidence from New Zealand and the United Kingdom is clear and unambiguous. The top judges there have become more powerful since the arrival of the respective Bills of Rights. How? Well, one of the main and little publicized devices is a provision in these statutory versions that's known as a reading down provision. Now, these reading down provisions end up being a license to rewrite. You can't strike down legislation. You get to rewrite legislation. So what these reading down provisions do is they direct the judges, so far as it is possible to do so, that's the wording in Victoria in the UK, or if they can, that's the wording in New Zealand, to read all other statutes as consistent with the enumerated rights. Right? So any other statute you have to interpret The Bill of Rights tells you, the judge, to, if at all possible, read that other statute in a way that you, the judge, happen to think is compatible with the enumerated list of rights. Of course, what is and is not consistent with such rights is wholly up to the judges, as is the question of what is and is not possible. Even the secondary question of what limits on rights are reasonable is one that bills of rights leave wholly with the unelected judges. So they, the judges, decide what aspects of other statutes are or are not consistent with the vague amorphous rights provisions. They, the judges, decide what is and is not possible insofar as giving other statutes a different meaning. And they, the judges, decide what is and is not reasonable. That's what a statutory bill of rights allows them to do. So remember that when you hear proponents of statutory bills of rights continually talk in gaseous platitudes about protecting fundamental rights. Remember that people disagree down in the quagmire of detail about where to draw the line to do that protecting. Remember, the judges have no greater moral, not talking about legal, but moral perspicacity in knowing what will and will not be the course of action that does that upholding of fundamental rights. They have no greater moral perspicacity than you or I or plumbers or secretaries, dare one say it, even politicians. And remember that when the unelected judges disagree, and remember that when the unelected judges disagree amongst themselves on these tough rights questions, and they're all tough, as they inevitably do, that the judges themselves resort to voting. They resort to letting the numbers count. The exact same decision-making procedure that so many Bill of Rights proponents like to belittle, at least in quiet moments of honesty over a drink or two. So turning back to these various sorts of reading down provisions, these directions to give the words of other statutes a meaning that you, the judge, happen to think is more moral and more in keeping with your own sense of the demands of fundamental human rights, I think you can all see that the danger is that just about any statutory language, however clear in wording and intent, might possibly be given some other meaning, might be read in a different way. Put differently, reading down provisions such as these throw open the possibility of Alice in Wonderland judicial interpretations, you know, where Alice says a word means whatever I want it to mean. They confer an interpretation on steroids power on the unelected judges. So true, it's true there's no power in a statutory Bill of Rights to invalidate or strike down legislation. But the judges can potentially accomplish just as much by rewriting it. By saying that seen through the prism, that means their own prism, of human rights, the words near black actually mean near white. They can make Bill of Rights skeptics like me half long for the honesty of judges in the U.S. and Canada who operate under a constitutionalized Bill of Rights, who actually strike down legislation rather than gut it of the meaning everyone knows it was intended to have. And notice how judicial rewriting of statutes infringes on rule of law values. By that I mean the value we citizens, maybe not the judges, but we citizens, all otherwise put on knowing in advance what the laws are that we're required to abide by, so that we can plan our lives accordingly and have our legitimate expectations satisfied. Now, of course, that allegation of Alice in Wonderland interpretations can sound alarmist. So the question arises, has anything remotely like that occurred under the UK and New Zealand reading down provisions? The ones we're told aren't going to do anything, really. Not really going to change things very much at all. Well, the answer is absolutely yes. Here I will simply quote from the leading House of Lords decision. That's the top UK court. It's only 5 years, a four-year-old case from 4 years ago. Listen to what Lord Nicholls, supported more or less by all the other lordships, was prepared to openly and explicitly say, and I'm quoting here, it's remarkable. It is now generally accepted that the application of Section 3, that's their reading down provision, it's equivalent to Section 32 in Victoria, that the application of Section 3 does not depend upon the presence of ambiguity in the legislation being interpreted. They don't need to have, you don't need ambiguity. Even if construed according to the ordinary principles of interpretation, the meaning of legislation admits of no doubt. It admits of no doubt at all. Section 3, the reading down provision, may nonetheless require the legislation to be given a different meaning. Section 3 may require the court to depart from the intention of Parliament. So you can know exactly what Parliament intended, but you, the judges, can give it a different meaning. So you can depart from the intention of the Parliament which enacted the legislation. It is also apt to require a court to read in words which change the meaning of the enacted legislation so as to make it Bill of Rights compliant. All the other lords, even Lord Millett in dissent, were broadly in agreement with these revolutionary views. There's nothing else to call them. Lord Steyne was clear that the interpretation adopted need not even be a reasonable one. And just to give you the full potency of these reading down provisions, it's crucial to realize that in reaching this result, their lordships overruled one of their own authorities, a case on the meaning of the exact same provision, an authority that was only 5 years old, and one that in which they had said the meaning was abundantly clear. Now, lest anyone be inclined to think this was some rogue case, name of the cases Guyden and Mendoza, note what was said 2 years later, so 2 years after Guyden, 2 years ago. I quote, the Human Rights Act 1998, which is the act in the UK which incorporates the European Convention on Human Rights, which is in effect their Bill of Rights, this created a new legal order. That was said in the case of Jackson. It is a new order, of course, in which a good deal more of the moral and political line drawing in society is being done by committees of ex-lawyers. And of course, that's what judges on a top court are. I don't think it is in any way an unfair characterization to say that what's happening in the United Kingdom is the diminishing of democracy, at least if you understand democracy in its usual sense of majority rules or letting the numbers count. And the various people who here in Australia are presently pushing for one of these statutory bills of rights, and I'm not actually totally clear whether that includes our Attorney General or not, but I would say that the people pushing for one of these should at least have the good graces to come clean and tell everyone that there is the potential for this statutory Bill of Rights of theirs to create a new legal order, one that will enhance significantly the role of unelected judges while diminishing the role of your elected representatives. Certainly, after looking at the experience of the United Kingdom, one could summarize what has thus far happened over there by saying that under a statutory Bill of Rights, the little harmless one that George Williams was talking about in the paper this morning, under a statutory Bill of Rights, the most senior judges of what was once considered to be the most interpretively conservative court in the common law world, that's the House of Lords, those same judges now tell us that they can give other statutes, all other statutes, statutes they concede would otherwise be clear and unambiguous, they can give those enactments the exact opposite meaning as that intended by the elected parliament. They can read words in, they can read words out, they can opt for clearly unwanted outcomes. Wow. As I said, that's Alice in Wonderland stuff to me. It certainly looks to me to amount to a power to redraft or rewrite disfavored statutes, and it is precisely that which Bill of Rights advocates are pushing for here in Australia now. It is largely that version of a statutory Bill of Rights, with a little bit of New Zealand's throwing in, that Victoria has enacted. What about New Zealand? I lived there 11 years. The experience in New Zealand with their reading down provision reinforces this assertion. Despite on the face of things, the Kiwis having the most enervated Bill of Rights imaginable. Geoffrey Palmer, who went on to be Prime Minister, wanted to bring in a Canadian-style entrenched Bill of Rights. He couldn't get it through. He couldn't even get it through his Labour Party colleagues, so he ended up opting for a statutory Bill of Rights. He couldn't get that through his Labour Party colleagues. He took out the remedies provision, which allows the judges to give so there'd be no remedy at all. He still couldn't get it through. He had to put in a Section 4 provision, which says this Bill of Rights loses to all other statutes, not just past ones, but present ones. It loses to everything. And he finally got it through. It's the most enervated Bill of Rights you could even imagine. So despite all that, what have they done over there in New Zealand? Well, the judges across the Tasman have done the following. A, in the first case ever to reach the highest domestic court, President Cook, who went on to sit in the House of Lords, he suggested that this new Bill of Rights, this new New Zealand Bill of Rights, with its reading down provision, may require a court to depart from long-established interpretations as regards the meaning to give to other statutes. In other words, legislative history was just ignored. B, the remedies clause, which had to be taken out to get the bill in, was immediately read back in, while creating a new public law remedy sounding, and that means based on, the Bill of Rights. That's the Bajent case, which also was based on implicitly on the reading down provision. C, this Section 4, this provision that says this Bill of Rights loses to all other statutes, was and has been more or less completely ignored. D, exclusion of evidence rules were rewritten and rewritten again to the advantage of the accused. E, judges simply gave themselves the power to issue declarations of incompatibility. The New Zealand Parliament didn't give it to them, but they saw that the judges were getting it in the UK in 1998, so they gave it to themselves with no statutory warrant whatsoever. That's the Moonen case. And here's what they came within one judicial vote of doing. They came within one judicial vote of saying that they, the judges, the New Zealand judges, could use the Bill of Rights with its reading down provision to say that old statutes, when they, the judges, perceived those old statutes to be inconsistent with the amorphous rights entitlements, could prevail over inconsistent statutes of more recent enactment. So in other words, three of the seven top Kiwi judges at the time thought that if the judges happened to conclude that an old statute, which was inconsistent with a new statute, well, if the old statute was more in keeping with rights than the new statute, the old statute could win. That's a breach of the doctrine of implied repeal, and it has amazing implications. Think about it. The doctrine of implied repeal, which is based on the notion that each generation should decide matters for itself, would go out the window. This would have been a power to choose whether newly enacted statutes can be ignored in favor of older existing statutes, ones the judges happen to prefer or to think more in keeping with their notion of what is a rights-respecting outcome. And this on the basis of an enfeebled, enervated Bill of Rights that's much weaker on its face than those of the United Kingdom or Victoria. All that Australian proponents of such instruments tend to say when you point this out is, A, that at least this worst sort of wild, unintended outcome, cases called PORA, did not in the end come to pass in New Zealand. True. 4-3 decision. The deciding judgment was based on other grounds. And B, even the New Zealand top judges have on one occasion disapproved of the UK approach. It's true. The UK is worse than New Zealand, from my point of view. So even if all the other matters I enumerated above are true, and they are, at least the New Zealand top judges haven't gone as far down the giving statutes a meaning you think they should have rather than the one they clearly do have path that the UK judges have. So, does that comfort anybody in the audience? I think I've said enough to back up my earlier claim that the experiences of the UK and New Zealand throw open at least the possibility of Alice in Wonderland interpretations, should we here in Australia opt for a statutory Bill of Rights. And were this to come to pass, it would look to me very much like what the judges do in Canada and the U.S. under constitutionalized bills of rights. There they strike down statutes based on their Bill of Rights. In the U.K. and New Zealand, they simply rewrite them under the guise of pretending to interpret them. They make them say what they, the judges, think they should say. And in New Zealand, they came within one vote from simply handing themselves the power to ignore new statutes in favor of other older inconsistent statutes. Now, no one could ever say with a straight face that reading down provisions that can do all that don't hold out the prospect of transferring much power to the unelected judiciary. Well, actually, that's not quite true, because lots of Bill of Rights proponents here in Australia do say this. They're just comprehensively wrong. So what do the singers of the Bill of Rights for Australia siren song say in response to that? And here I hope you'll forgive me for descending into a technicality or two, but if you bear with me, you might just think it worthwhile. In effect, they point to four words that are part of the Victorian Charter but are not part of the UK or New Zealand Bills of Rights. So I'm still talking about the reading down provisions. Here's what the UK's one says. It says, so far as it is possible to do so, other legislation must be read in a way which is compatible with this Bill of Rights. Right? By contrast, Victoria's Charter, Section 32, says, so far as it is possible to do so, consistently with their purpose, all statutory provisions must be interpreted in a way that is compatible with human rights. Now, it's those four extra words, consistently with their purpose, that we are now being told will make all the difference. It's those four words that are going to be our bulwark against the tide of interpretation on steroids type House of Lords results. Results that are not so much interpretation as redrafting. It's going to be those four words that will ensure that Parliament in Australia remains supreme within the confines of the Constitution. If I can paraphrase Churchill, never has so much been owed by so many to four words. At least that's going to be the case if we're able to take this latest incarnation of the pro-Bill of Rights camp's assurances seriously. Now, before I trace out their argument and why it's a feeble one, notice that this Bill of Rights debate in Australia has taken on something of a smoke and mirrors quality to it. you can never quite pin down proponents on what they actually think or believe. To start, not that long ago, most proponents were in favor of a vigorous U.S.-style or Canadian-style entrenched constitutionalized Bill of Rights. After something of an apparent Damascene conversion for some of them, not least when Australian voters continually rejected their hopes for one of these, we then learned that it was only a purportedly harmless little statutory Bill of Rights they wanted. What harm could a mere statutory version cause? Just go and ask people in the UK. But as the evidence came in from the UK and New Zealand, that position was abandoned too in favor of this new gloss. You see, these four words are going to make all the difference in reining in the unelected judges. It's the consistently with their purpose. That's the four key words. Here's the gist of their argument. With these four words in place, judges are directed, they're still directed to read down all of their statutes, just as they are in the UK and New Zealand. But, and here's the thing, here in Australia, they're being directed to do so only when the reading down outcome will be consistent with the purpose of the statute being interpreted. So here's the question. How constraining on the point of application interpreter of a statute is that extra four-word injunction? You can still read words in, you can read words out. You have no need to wait for any ambiguity before doing so. Indeed, and here's the thing, Section 32, sub 2 of the Victorian Charter explicitly tells the judges to look overseas. Take a look at what they're doing in Guyden over in the UK. You can take that into account. You can copy it if you want. So given that subsection 2 of Victoria's Charter explicitly tells the judges to consider overseas case law, including these egregious House of Lords and New Zealand cases, you can even copy all these international trends. You can do all that, provided only that the meaning you end up attributing to the statute after you do this exercise is one that is consistent with its purpose. In other words, you, the judge, think is consistent with its purpose. Because remember, it's always up to the judge. So to repeat the key question, how constraining on a judge is that? Well, in my view, the answer is not very much at all. I would say that any half-decent lawyer told that his preferred human rights rewriting of a statute would only be allowed if he could also say that it was in keeping with the underlying purpose of the statute would rarely have all that much difficulty driving a truck through that sort of purported constraint. The fact is that most decent-sized statutes have a multitude of purposes. Here's how the famous American legal scholar Lon Fuller of Harvard made the point about the porousness of this sort of constraint, the porousness of purposive limitations or constraints when it comes to interpretation. In his famous mock hypothetical, The Case of the Spelunking Explorers, I'm quoting Fuller now, who's putting himself in the shoes of a judge. We are all familiar with the process by which the judicial reform of disfavored legislative enactments is accomplished. Anyone who has followed the written opinions of Mr. Justice Foster, he's the person who likes purposive interpretations, will have had an opportunity to see it at work. I am personally so familiar with the process that in the event of my brother's incapacity, I am sure I could write a satisfactory opinion for him without any prompting whatever, beyond being informed whether he liked the effect of the terms of the statute or not. In other words, do you want me to strike it down or not? That's all I need to know. I can write the judgment for you. He goes on. The process, Fuller goes on, the process of judicial reform requires three steps. The first of these is to divine some single purpose which the statute serves. This is done although not one statute in 100 has any such single purpose, and although the objectives of nearly every statute are differently interpreted by the classes of its sponsors. The second step is to discover that a mythical being called the legislator, in pursuit of his imagined purpose, overlooked something, left a little gap, some imperfection in his work. Then comes the final and most refreshing part of the task, which is, of course, to fill in the blank thus created. Quod erat faciendum, doing that which needed to be done. So here's the truth of the matter. Any judge inclined to fancy himself or herself a latter-day philosopher king, an arbiter for the rest of us of what is and is not in keeping with the amorphous notion of fundamental human rights, any judge like that will not in the least be prevented from doing so by these four extra words consistently with their purpose. Those judges who balk at what the House of Lords have been doing the last 4 years would balk without these four extra words. And those judges who would not balk who think they have some sort of pipeline to God when it comes to all these incredibly contentious and debatable line-drawing exercises connected to rights-based disputes that always and everywhere lead to disagreement and dissensus amongst smart, reasonable, well-informed, nice people. Well, those sort of judges are simply not going to be deterred by these four words. Does anyone really think, hand on heart, that these four words would have made the crucial difference to a Lord Stein or a Lord Hoffman or a President Cook? Discretion being the better part of valor, I refrain from mentioning any Australian judges here, but I'm quite sure those in the audience would not find it an overly taxing job to list a few for themselves. If the assurances against runaway judicial conceit, If the assurances against runaway judicial conceit and overpowerful judges and juristocracy and critarchy, those latter two words are just fancy names for government by unelected judges, well, if those assurances now rest on the four words consistently with their purpose, then I'm afraid that they don't really rest on very much at all. So reading down provisions, which is just one tool that we're giving judges in a statutory Bill of Rights, well, these reading down provisions can turn, and in the UK and New Zealand to a significant extent, they have turned statutory Bill of Rights into something that gives the unelected judges almost as much power as they're afforded under a Canadian-style Bill of Rights or an American-style one. Now, you might like that, or like me, you might not like that. But pretending that it's not a possibility, which is what consistently is being done right now, well, that sort of pretense is at odds with what is happening in jurisdictions that have already gone down the statutory Bill of Rights path. It is simple prevarication or naivete, you pick. In fact, let me say that again. It is simple prevarication or naivete, you pick. And in those other jurisdictions, as with here, we were given hearty assurances before the enactment of the Bill of Rights that the judges here in this jurisdiction are so interpretively consistent, you have nothing to worry about. I heard it in Canada before the Charter of Rights came in 92. I heard it in New Zealand before their Bill of Rights. They said it in the UK. Elsewhere, those assurances have proven to be hollow to the core. So you have to wonder why we can be so confident that the judges here aren't going to go down some sort of similar route. Anyway, given my time constraints, I'll say no more about reading down provisions. Let me say instead a few words about the other main provision in the statutory Bill of Rights, another main provision that also transfers power to the unelected judges. Yes, there is more than one, although here I'll have to be brief. Then I want to move back to some general concluding remarks and throw it open to questions. Section 36.2 of the Charter, the Victorian Charter of Rights, has a provision that gives that state Supreme Court, came into force in January, the power to declare that it, so they can declare that in its opinion a statutory provision cannot be interpreted consistently with one of the enumerated rights. Now, I don't have time to go through all the problems with that provision, although I did bring some off-prints from an article. It's just going to be kindling, so if you want it, I've got about 10 of them, which goes into more detail of the problem. But let me just mention one of the problems. Notice that Section 36, the Declaration's power, furthers the tendency, and it's one that's indulged in all the time by Bill of Rights proponents, it's this tendency to conflate, A, what the judges think about rights, and B, what is actually the case about rights. It's as though a committee of ex-lawyers had some sort of authoritative, definitive, and frankly to me it's wholly mysterious, they had some sort of ability to know and declare precisely where to draw all the highly contestable, disputed lines that come from turning political disputes into pseudo-legal ones in the language of rights. Now, let's put to one side all the potential Chapter 3 and Section 73, 75, 76 issues related to advisory opinions. Let's instead just take this declaration power on its own terms. In the absence of any power to strike down legislation, because statutory Bills of Rights don't allow that, and assuming, wildly optimistically in my view, that the judges are not going to go too far down the Alice in Wonderland path with the reading down provision, it's precisely this declaration's power, these judicial declarations, that are supposed to give rise to all the wonderful benefits that a Bill of Rights is going to give rise to. The claim by proponents is that there's going to be some sort of a dialogue. You only have to hear the word dialogue, but it's got to be good. It's going to be some sort of dialogue, and that the legislature, on learning that one of its statutes has attracted one of these judicial declarations, well, the legislature will go back and they'll think again, they'll ponder, they'll reflect on how best to accomplish their aims, while at the same time attempting to uphold the various enunciated rights. That's the claim. However, that claim is only remotely plausible where the elected legislature is left in a position in which it feels it can, at least sometimes, disagree with and overrule the judges. Remember, judges are not gods. And so there is no reason at all to think that their view on some moral issue, not legal, but some moral issue, is by definition the correct one. So if the Victorian Charter is really going to result in a dialogue, a sort of scenario where, in which the judges' views do not routinely prevail, then it must be the case that at least sometimes, in fact, the elected legislators stand up to the unelected judges and they say, in effect, well, we've heard your view and we've considered your view about how these rights ought to play out, but after more reflection, we disagree with you. If the judges always prevail, that doesn't resemble a dialogue. There's a Canadian legal scholar who summarizes this talk about dialogue between the judges and the legislatures in these terms. He says, the kind of dialogue proponents are talking about is the kind of dialogue where the judges are the customers and they walk into a restaurant and they sit down and they order something for breakfast and the legislature is the waitress and they bring the judges their meal. That's the kind of dialogue they're talking about. Now, if that's the kind of dialogue you're talking about, then there's no doubt a Bill of Rights will enhance dialogue. But if you're talking about any other kind of dialogue, then the signs on this, will the legislature ever stand up to the judges' front, are extremely bleak. In Canada, with its constitutionalized Charter of Rights, there's nevertheless an override provision, which in theory allows the elected Canadian federal parliament to trump the judges. The elected federal parliament in Canada has never used that override, not one single time in 26 years. Now, we're told that can be ignored, because that's what flows from a constitutionalized Bill of Rights. What we need to do is focus on statutory bills of rights. So what about the UK? It has a statutory Bill of Rights. It has exactly the same sort of provision as Victoria, because they copied the UK, where the judges are allowed to make declarations of incompatibility. So what happens over in the UK after the judges issue them? Does the elected legislature ever dispute what almost always amounts to a highly debatable line-drawing call, one over which sincere, reasonable, you can't say this enough, well-informed, nice people can and do disagree? Well, the answer is no. According to Klug and Sturmer, they were writing in 2005, and I quote, in every single case where remedial action had not been taken before the declaration was made, the government responded by repealing, amending, or committing to repeal or amend the relevant provision. In other words, after every single judicial declaration of incompatibility in the UK, every single one of them, the elected legislature deferred to the judges, about two dozen of them. And up to date, that's still the case. Now, dialogue should be made of sterner stuff than that. And so, too, should claims that we're hearing now that this declaration power in a statutory Bill of Rights will not make it impossible. It won't make it impossible, we hear, for the elected parliament to disagree with the judges. It will not have the de facto effect of making the judges' views the one that end up prevailing, the ones that end up prevailing. Well, I disagree with that. Now, my allotted time is virtually up, so let me turn to a few concluding remarks. As a native-born Canadian, I had thought about recounting to you what the judges have done in Canada with their Bill of Rights. I know it's a constitutionalized one. But the way things are going with statutory versions, there won't be that much difference between what the UK and Canadian judges can do. Of course, when I point to my native Canada, I'm often told I'm scaremongering. But in this instance, I figure a little scaremongering might go a long way. So let's recall some, just some, of the Bill of Rights decisions of the Supreme Court of Canada. The judges there have decided that free speech concerns trump health and safety concerns in the context of tobacco and commercial advertising. The Canadian Parliament enacted legislation, health and safety legislation, which included you can't put big billboards up advertising tobacco outside of schools. The judges disagreed. They struck it down 5-4, right to free speech. And even that didn't get the legislature to override the judges. The judges in Canada have decided what campaign finance rules are acceptable. They have decided that each and every refugee to Canada must be given an oral hearing. Sorry, each and every refugee claimant to Canada must be given an oral hearing at a cost, by the Canadian government's own reckoning, of billions of dollars and massive ongoing delays. Say what you will about Australia's refugee regime. If you want a worse one, look at Canada. and that the judges have decided that the legislature's ban on private health insurance was unconstitutional. Canada had a socialized, one-tier, no private health care system. Now, I actually think the health care system in Australia is miles better than Canada. That's my own personal view. I like the fact that the Canadian judges struck down the one-tier socialized system in the sense that I think that's a better outcome, but it appalls me that unelected judges are trumping the elected parliament on how the healthcare system runs. Well, they did that. That bothered people on the political left. The judges also decided that the Canadian judges decided that the confining of marriage to opposite-sex couples breached the Bill of Rights. They have twice overruled the federal parliament on whether convicted and incarcerated prisoners must in all cases be allowed to vote. Canada had a provision, a statute that said if you get convicted, you couldn't vote. Struck down by the Supreme Court using the Bill of Rights. So what the Canadian Parliament did is the Senate conducted hearings all over Canada for about 2 or 3 years, and they came up with a compromise piece of legislation where only the most serious prisoners, people convicted of murder and rape, they would lose their entitlement to vote while they were in prison. And that compromise went back to the Canadian Supreme Court, and 5-4, that got struck down. And in fact, the Chief Justice said, here's your little blurb on dialogue. I quote the Chief Justice, Beverly McLaughlin, "Finally, the fact that the challenged denial of the right to vote followed judicial rejection of an even more comprehensive denial does not mean that the court should defer to Parliament as part of a dialogue. Parliament must ensure that whatever law it passes, at whatever stage, conforms to the Bill of Rights. The healthy and important promotion of a dialogue between legislature and the court should not be debased to a rule of, if at first you don't succeed, try again." And in fact, in the later of those two cases, the Sauvé case, the Chief Justice of Canada, Beverly McLaughlin, referred obliquely to countries that disagree with her court's 5-4 ruling. And in the minority decision, the judge lists what those countries are, and they are Australia, the UK, the US, and New Zealand. In her judgment, she refers to those countries as, and I quote, "self-proclaimed democracies." Now, perhaps I should pause for a moment and allow fully to sink in the staggering self-assuredness. No, the out-and-out moral sanctimoniousness and self-righteousness of a top Canadian judge, and I've said this while she's in the audience, of a top Canadian judge calling New Zealand, Australia, the US, and the UK self-proclaimed democracies. What would have been the reaction if George Bush had said that? I could go on and mention other cases. The one striking down compromise abortion legislation. However, let it suffice simply to recall the case of the referendary remuneration of provincial court judges, a scandalous decision in which the Canadian Supreme Court struck down legislation reducing the salaries of provincial judges as part of a general province-wise freeze on civil servants' pay. As Professor Jeff Goldsworthy here at Monash describes it, this decision, and I quote, "First-year law students are taught to clear their heads of mush and think like lawyers. In this case, the Canadian Supreme Court seemed to have undergone something like the same process in reverse. But there's a difference. The Supreme Court's mush is calculated. It's mush in the service of an agenda. It is a disingenuous rationalization of a result strongly desired by the Canadian judges on policy grounds." So I finish with this thought. Democracy is the best form of government for people who aren't sure they're right. Bills of rights, by contrast, are for people who think their moral antennae are better than everyone else's. For people who are sure they're right. Actually, that's not quite correct, is it? Because bills of rights, in turning debatable, contentious, political and moral line-drawing exercises into pseudo-legal exercises, where one side or the other has to be proclaimed to be the one on the side of fundamental human rights, these instruments actually empower a very small group of unelected judges. The bet that proponents of bills of rights are making isn't that they have a pipeline to God. The bet they're making is that the judiciary does. They're betting that judges have greater moral and political perspicacity than do the elected representatives of the people. It's an unattractive bet, in my view, when it's presented openly and honestly, rather than when it's disguised in moral abstractions and grand proclamations about protecting rights. As though Australia were some sort of North Korea at present, whose citizens lacked rights. As though at present, without a Bill of Rights, we in Australia didn't outscore Canada with an incredibly strong Bill of Rights in terms of the scope citizens are afforded to express themselves without constraints. There's more free speech in Australia than there is in Canada right now in terms of being able to say what you want campaign finance rules, look at how hate speech provisions are treated, look at a defamation, as though Australia didn't outscore the United Kingdom in terms of having the less harsh anti-terrorism provisions. Because we do. Ours are less harsh than the UK's, and they have a Bill of Rights. At core, if we're all at all honest, any sort of Bill of Rights is about imposing an aristocratic or anti-democratic element into government. People won't tell you that. It's about handing an awful lot of line-drawing powers as regards an awful lot of highly contentious moral and political issues to committees of ex-lawyers, to judges. And those judges will resolve their disagreements on these issues by themselves voting. Again, the only size difference being the size of the franchise. Those of us who think democratic decision-making, for all its many and obvious faults, you'll know Churchill, like I'm paraphrasing, democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. Well, those of us who think democratic decision-making is nevertheless the least bad form of government going, and certainly better than what you'd get if you added an element of judicial oversight, we'd better start voicing our opposition to a Commonwealth Bill of Rights now, before it's too late. It's not going to be easy. Emotively laden appeals up in the Olympian heights of amorphous moral abstractions have a certain attraction in some quarters. So it's time to start explaining why that attraction is superficial, vacuous, and down in the quagmire of day-to-day detail, it's at odds with giving each Australian a more or less equal say in how we're all governed. 14 minutes for questions.
Okay. Well, if that hasn't provoked some questions, I don't know what would. Yes. I'm going to go to genuine questioners, not regular speech makers. Thank you.
Well, I hope this is a genuine question.
Oh, I have great confidence in you.
I was fascinated by so many aspects of your address, but let me try and focus on three. First, I was intrigued by your somewhat sarcastic criticism of courts making decisions by majority. Now, we live in a constitutional democracy, and the courts regularly adjudicate on challenges to the validity of legislation, and they make their decisions by majority. How else? Would you suggest that Parliament should be the final arbiter of its own constitutional powers? No, that's the role of the courts.
Shall I take that question first?
But can I finish that one? If it's the courts that make the decision, how else would they adjudicate otherwise than by majority when you have an appellate court? It's a question.
No, ask the question.
I didn't know you were in the chair.
I think we're getting to the question.
That's that. Do you want to
deal with that? What my point there was is that people who propose bills of rights, by and large, either explicitly or implicitly, bring into their argument something about the tyranny of the majority and the fundamental problem with deciding on a majority rules basis. All my point was is that's how judges decide. Judges don't decide based on who writes the most moral judgment. The other problem is that in most pieces of legislation, I don't have any problem with judges voting, because how else are they going to decide? You're perfectly right. But normally when the judges, interpret a tax act or they interpret Companies Act, and the legislature doesn't like the outcome of that interpretation, they bring in an amendment. You can't do that with a Bill of Rights. The fundamental difference, even with a statutory Bill of Rights, is the judges get the last word. It's not the same as common law decision making, where the judges create a long sort of set of rules about personal negligence, say, and the New Zealand Parliament comes along and passes a no-fault tort system, where they say, well, we've heard what you judges say, we're changing it. Every single time the judges make a declaration, every single time in the UK, there's no response. Every single time the judges make a decision in Canada under their Bill of Rights, even though in theory, formally, the Parliament could respond, they can't respond because these things are sold at such a high level of moral abstractions where they just you get this mantra of we're protecting people's rights, as though that's some sort of uncontentious, obvious thing, that they're in fact, the legislature cannot respond. That's the difference. And so what you're stuck with is seven judges will decide by voting what we end up with no response for us. At heart, I'm a Democrat. That really, really bothers me.
You made no mention of the fact that a Human Rights Bill Act provides a yardstick for measuring future legislation. We've seen the difference between the Commonwealth and the ACT in relation to the anti-terrorism legislation, and you'll know the outcome. Do you not agree that that was a very important outcome in the ACT and a much better one than the Commonwealth one? And on the reading down provisions, can I give you an example where a reading down provision would have introduced a much more beneficial result and ask you to comment on it? You'll be familiar with the El-Khateb decision, where Mr. El-Khateb was a failed refugee applicant who was stateless. He couldn't be deported anywhere because no state would take him. The legislation provided that someone in his position had to be held in detention until either a visa was granted or he was deported, but he wasn't going to get a visa, and they couldn't find anywhere to deport him. The court held that that meant that he was to be held in detention indefinitely, by 4-3. Now, we now know that one of the members of the majority, Justice McHugh, has said since his retirement that had there been a Bill of Rights, he could have interpreted that legislation against human rights standards and found the other way. Wouldn't that have been a preferable outcome? Does that not illustrate the benefit of a reading down provision?
I'll take them in order and try to be brief. The first point, it's true that I haven't mentioned all of the many parts of a Bill of Rights. There's lots of other bad parts to them. There's one that in the UK one, in the Victorian one, Section 28 is a statement of compatibility where the minister or the Attorney General gets up in the House and says yes or no, this bill being introduced is or is not, in my view, compatible with the Bill of Rights. Sounds great, but when you look at and you read people like Huscroft and Hebert, on what basis do, I mean, the idea was supposed to be that the parliamentarians would start thinking twice about whether their bills infringe rights, but what ends up happening is that you hire a bunch of lawyers in the Attorney General's chambers or somewhere, and the lawyers decide whether the bill's compatible with bills of rights. And how do? They look and see what the judges have done. And if they haven't done anything here, they look and see what the judges have done in Canada. So in other words, even at the statement of compatibility stage, it becomes legalized and lawyer-driven. And my friend's comment about the terrorism legislation. Well, the UK has a very strong Bill of Rights, and that has done nothing to make their terrorism legislation less harsh than Australia's. Australia's is less harsh than the UK's. You can be held in detention in the UK for 28 days. What is it here? 2, 4? I forget. 28 days. Now, it's true that the ACT has incredibly liberal laws, but I don't think it's the Bill of Rights myself. I think it's the kind of people who live in the ACT, personally. What about Al-Khateb? Well, Al-Khateb, you know my answer to that because I've written. I think that the four majority judges in Al-Khateb got it right. The best judge in the U.S. in the last century was Oliver Wendell Holmes, and he says, my job is this as a judge. If the people, through their elected representatives, want to go to hell, then my job is to help them. That's what I'm paid for. The problem with the minority judges in Al-Khateb is, I call it do the right thing judging. They're just rewriting the legislation. Now, if the question is, wouldn't it be nice if a Bill of Rights allowed judges to just rewrite legislation, then my answer is no. And in fact, after Al-Khateb, I don't know exactly what the legislature did, but they actually softened it. That's what you should do. If you don't like Al-Khateb, get out there, spend a few Saturdays working for a party that's going to change the rules on stateless refugees. The worst thing you can do is rely on a few judges to fix the system for you. If that's what you want, then you and I fundamentally disagree on what the best way to live in a democracy where you can't always win in a democracy. I mean, at my university, I never win, but leave that aside. You can't expect to win every issue. You can't expect to win every issue, even if it's a moral and political issue that you feel very strongly about. The fact is, if your decision-making rule is count everyone equal and let the numbers count, you're going to lose some. Your remedy is not to hope that a few unelected judges sort of skew the balance so that you win. Your remedy is to put in a little time. Work for a political party.
Okay. Now, is anybody game to ask a question after that? Yes? Can you come to the microphone?
I can hear her.
Well, we can't record it.
Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry.
We need to record it, though.
I'll be quiet.
As one of these enlightened citizens of the ACT, we're already being freaked out here. I'm very morally opposed to cloning. We are debating it right now in the ACT legislature. But, of course, the bill to permit it has that little moral cachet of saying it has been found compatible with the ACT Human Rights Act, as if that's meant to impress me. You know, when you lobby, you're told it's compatible. What if it's incompatible, my view? I'm still entitled to argue it. And then we have a very interesting gloss. Mr. Stanhope's Human Rights Act said it was based upon the ICCPR provisions. Article 6 says everyone has a right to life. In the preparatory works to that convention, it was quite clear that there were very strong differences about the abortion issue as to whether that applied. And countries have gone their own different ways. But our Human Rights Act here actually adds a paragraph in Section 9 and says these rights do not apply before birth. I think, well, that's a reach. And in a course, in a lecture I attended at the ANU about 2 years ago, our Human Rights Commissioner, Dr. Watches, on being asked why was this gloss added, said it was obvious that it shouldn't apply before birth. And I said, well, some of us would like to sort of argue about that. And she said, but the Chief Minister doesn't want it introduced. I said, well, tough luck, we will. But it's extraordinary. Legislatures themselves, what does Professor Allen think? Legislatures themselves seem intent on glossing human rights statements, but it will come back and affect them when they do something that the lawyers don't want them to do.
Okay, well, you and I could probably sit around and debate. What would be the situation if the legislature actually sat down and debated between themselves whether a particular bill was compatible with human rights? And you might not like that, or you might, but that's not what happens. It's way worse than that. When bills are declared to be compatible with bills of rights or not compatible, that is on the basis of a few students just out of law school having sat down and they read what the judges are saying. They don't look and see what it's not a what does the legislature think or what do the legislators think. The minister gets opinions based on what the lawyers are deciding, based on what the judges are deciding. If it hasn't been so in New Zealand, when they look and decide if a bill is compatible or not, the people in Crown Law Office, you know, the 12 or 13 full-time lawyers who are working on the Bill of Rights, they look and see, what have our top judges said about this sort of thing? And if they can't find anything in New Zealand, they then look at the Canadian Supreme Court or the American Supreme Court. Your statement of compatibility is a statement of what judges think. That's the irony of it. Yes, you're right. There are other knock-on negative effects of a Bill of Rights that I haven't got to because it was a fairly short period of time. But there's no doubt that if you are, say, a legislator in Congress in the U.S. and you know that sitting behind you are some philosopher king judges, you can abdicate your responsibility. You could pass a piece of legislation that outlaws flag burning, not because you support that ridiculous piece of legislation, but because you're very confident that the judges behind you are going to strike it down. So you can play. You don't have to take any moral responsibility for your legislation. Absolutely, that's a knock-on negative effect, and that will certainly happen, although it happens more in the U.S. because they have such a long history.
Our intent on debating all those issues, whether our views are popular or not, which is what democracy is about.
What you're saying is this is already emerging in the ACT.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. We're meant to be freaked out of a particular argument.
Good.
Yes. This lady here did put her hand up in a tentative sort of way.
You've mentioned the the impact that a Bill of Rights can have on campaign finance reform laws. I'm really curious as to whether it's statutory or constitutionally entrenched, exactly how that line is drawn and what cases we've seen in other countries.
Well, the cases in Canada, one, they've come out of Alberta. Well, basically the question is this, really, you have to, campaign finance questions, you know, how are you going to structure your electoral campaign? So Australia has some public money go in, and the U.S. tends to be a more wide-open one. And so what happens is you trigger the question of the right to free speech. If you're a multi-gabillionaire, can you spend all your money to buy lots of television time to support one political party over another one? And obviously you have to make a compromise between some sort of view that you don't want money, wealth, having too big a role in election campaigns, and on the other hand, not wanting to stifle people's views when they go to speak, express themselves in terms of the party they prefer to win. And what the judges, there's a long line of cases in the U.S. and Canada And the American judges consistently come down on the side of, if you try to bring in any legislative constraints on money, the judges tend to say that's a breach of the First Amendment, free speech. Now, John McCain and McCain-Feingold, I think it was, they have a compromise, but it hasn't worked very well. And so the Americans tend to be really pro-free speech, which puts very few limits on campaign finance. Canada, the legislature passes really big limits on free speech in terms of, if you want to characterize it that way. In other words, they try to take some of the money out of campaign finance rules. And the Canadian Supreme Court has upheld that because the judges like that. Because we've had 40 years of Liberal Party government in Canada, so every single judge in Canada pretty much has been appointed by the Liberal Party, which is another way to get around a Bill of Rights if you can stay in power that long. Right, so the question is, well, what about Australia? And ironically, of course, as you probably know, in Australia, the so-called implied rights jurisprudence, where the High Court just made, in my view, just made up some rights because they weren't there and they wanted to put some in, the first one was the ACTV case. And that's ironic because the judges decided that in the fabric and inner workings of the Constitution, it's all very ineffable stuff. But somehow there was this freedom of political communication during campaigns. And it sounds great when you read it. But the practical effect was that legislation, I think it had been brought in by a Labour government to try to take some of the money out of campaign financing, got struck down as unconstitutional. Now, I don't know where I stand on the first order preferences of those sort of things. Probably, you know, here's the irony, I'm probably with the judges. My own nice middle class sensibilities, I probably get more of my first order preferences satisfied by the judges. But ACTV and all of those implied rights cases really offend me just as much as a Bill of Rights because the judges are making highly debatable calls. It's a highly debatable call about where you're going to draw the line in terms of how much money you're going to let people spend of their own to try to influence political campaigns. And there's no right answer in the sense of an obvious, morally correct answer. Bills of Rights never trigger the sort of case people like to talk about where there's some little blue-eyed baby boy about to get murdered and the Bill of Rights steps in to save him. That's never what the case is. It's always highly debatable calls about, you know, where you're going to structure your campaign finance rules, your defamation regime, or, you know, veils to school or something like that. So there's no doubt that Bills of Rights have had a huge effect on campaign finance. But is it the case that different judges in different jurisdictions draw different lines? Absolutely. Canadians draw a line that really favors limits. The Americans draw lines that put hardly any limits. And in fact, that's another irony. When the judges under a Bill of Rights say they're going to look overseas for guidance, they can get any answer they want. You tell me the answer you want, I'll tell you the jurisdiction to look at.
Now, there was a lady over here who, I think we'll make this the last question. Can you gallop to the microphone?
Thanks very much. I'm just wondering, Bill of Rights are often criticised because of your freezing in time of particular moral or political kind of environment and views about rights, and it's interesting to hear argument, which is on the other side, which is a Bill of Rights, a statutory Bill of Rights will open slather to judges to interpret. I'm just wondering if your views about a Bill of Rights as entrenching in particular.
I think that that's a straw man. That the sort of people who say, oh, well, a Bill of Rights is going to lock us in are people who want a Bill of Rights. The judges are so unconstrained that outside of Justice Scalia in the U.S., there's almost no one who says that this is a hard version of originalism where someone like Justice Scalia in the U.S. Supreme Court says, the way to interpret the Bill of Rights is to give it the meaning that the people at the time originally understood it to have. It's a version of originalism. And actually, if you actually flesh out his argument, it's not a bad, it's a fairly persuasive one, because he says, so in other words, a Bill of Rights is providing a floor below which government can't go. But if you want more than that, if you want legislation that allows same-sex marriage, or you want legislation to allow anything, then you've got parliamentary sovereignty. You're elected legislature. There's nothing in the Bill of Rights that stops you from having more liberal outcomes. And so Scalia's argument is, we have to interpret Bills of Rights as setting a floor, and they don't move. If you want to change the Bill of Rights, then you need a constitutional amendment. And people go, oh, that's awful. How do we keep pace with civilization? You know, that's 200 years old. What do we do 250 years down the road? And Scalia says, you pass a statute is what you do. Nobody's stopping you from doing that. What's the big deal? It's called voting, says Scalia. Now, That's an attractive position in my view. If you're going to have a Bill of Rights, give me a bunch of Scalias who are just going to lock things in. I don't want people, you know, keeping pace with civilization and treating a Bill of Rights as a living tree. But the fact of the matter is there's one Scalia and there's thousands of non-Scalias. And so as a practical matter, judges don't actually lock things in. It doesn't happen outside of Scalia and Thomas in the U.S. What judges do is they say, this is a part of our Constitution, it's a living thing, it needs to branch out, it needs to blah, blah, blah. And so they say we need to keep pace. But what they mean is we judges can amend the Constitution. Everyone else has to use Section 128. And so it will not be locked in. What will happen is it'll be amended from time to time as the various justices of the High Court feel in their view after, you know, when it needs updating. Everyone else will have to use Section 128. It'll be impossible. So I don't think the threat of locking things in, which isn't nearly as much of a threat as some people pretend, because you can still pass a statute. You're never locked in. You know, it's always a ceil, a floor. You never stop from going any higher. That's not a threat, because that's just as a factual matter. There are no judges like that, really. Very few.
Okay, well, we're a bit over time, so we'll call a halt there. Please join me in thanking him for a stimulating lecture. Thank you.